content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the February 20th, 2026 issue of the Week. In our cover drawing this week, we have in the background, it's a bonfire. It's a book burning. It's hard to tell the titles of the books, but let's see. One of them is called On Juneteenth. One of them is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And the other one you can see, I can't tell what the title is, but it's got a picture of Barack Obama on the front of it. At any rate, in the foreground, we have a smiling President Donald Trump. He's holding up a book for the viewer that says, titled, The White People's History of the United States. And the headline is Slash and Burn, Trump's Attempt to Rewrite American History. So that shows up as one of the talking points articles. We'll try to get that. But we'll start with the first main story. Deadlock in Congress over ICE reforms. What happened? The head of ICE defended his agents and said they were just getting started this week as congressional Democrats vowing to block funding it for the Department of Homeland Security unless Republicans agree to new restrictions on President Trump's immigration crackdown. Testifying before the House Homeland Security Committee, Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Todd Lyons rejected mounting criticisms that his agents are over-aggressive, undertrained, and trampling citizens' civil rights. He refused to answer questions on the fatal shootings of Minneapolis protesters Renee Good and Alex Pretty, citing ongoing investigations, and denounced Democratic lawmakers who have compared ICE to the Gestapo. If you don't want to be called a fascist regime or secret police, Representative Dan Goldman, Democrat from New York, told Lyons, then stop acting like one. Lyons blamed unprecedented levels of aggressive interference by protesters for spiking tensions and putting agents at risk, and said aggressive enforcement would continue. Let me send a message to anyone who thinks you can intimidate us. You will fail. Democrats laid out 10 demands that must be met before they'd vote to fund DHS. They included barring agents from wearing masks and entering homes without judicial warrants, and prohibiting enforcement at sensitive locations such as schools and hospitals. Republicans called the measures too restrictive. They want to make it almost impossible for ICE to do its job, said Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. With DHS funding set to expire February 13th, and Democrats united in opposition to stopgap funding, a shutdown of the department's agencies seemed near certain as the week went to press. Unless there are real far-reaching fundamental reforms that rein in an agency that is out of control, said Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut, we need to hang tough. What the columnist said. There's a path here to compromise that will curb ICE's excesses without undermining its mission, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The agency clearly rushed to get new officers in the field, hiring more than 12,000 in less than a year and giving most only 3 months of training. Improved training. Excuse me. My apologies there. I forgot to turn off my phone ringer. So picking back up, improved training and oversight would go a long way toward restoring public trust. Agents should also wear body cams, show their faces, and obtain a judicial warrant before storming into someone's home. Such accountability won't impede them from going after threats to public safety. There's little will to compromise, said my award in Politico. On the GOP side, hardliners are dead set against trying ICE's hands with new red tape. But given the bipartisan uproar after the Good and Pretty shootings, Democrats believe they have the leverage. A sizable majority of Americans say ICE has gone too far and want significant changes, said Ben Camisar and Bridget Bowman in NBCNews.com. In a new NBC News poll, 72% said ICE should be reformed or abolished, including 86% of independents. Only 29% of Americans think the agency should continue in its current form. Democrats must stand firm on judicial warrants, said law professor Elena Fogel and Kate Evans in The Hill. In a recent memo reversing longstanding practice, Lyons empowered agents to enter homes with only administrative warrants issued by ICE officials. It's a clear and dangerous overstep. There are few rights more fundamental than the promise that the government cannot come barging into your home, not at least without first explaining to a detached and neutral judge why they need to. We can't let ICE rip up the Fourth Amendment to make its job easier. A DHS shutdown won't actually affect immigration enforcement, said Ed Kilgore in New York. ICE got a $75 billion windfall in last year's Big Beautiful Bill, leaving its agents immune to Democratic efforts to curb their activities by denying them money. Instead, FEMA, the TSA, the Coast Guard, and other DHS sub-agencies will go dark. Democrats and Republicans will vie to spin a shutdown that will burden air travelers, imperil any response to natural disasters, and eviscerate around 200,000 federal employees. Democrats have no choice but to fight, said Jamelle Bouie in the New York Times. They can't stand aside as masked federal agents shoot and beat protesters, immigrants, and anyone who crosses their path, or as thousands of migrants remain locked up in filthy and overcrowded ICE detention facilities. Someday there will be a reckoning over these atrocities, just as there was over the Klan's crimes during Reconstruction and the U.S. government's internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. But for now, Trump's crackdown must be stopped, and America must look right in the face of what we have become. Here's a shorter second main story. Congress demands answers on Epstein files. What happened? Democratic lawmakers this week accused the Trump administration of engaging in a cover-up of the Jeffrey Epstein files after the Justice Department released more documents that contained horrifying implications of torture and child rape, but had the names of some of the alleged perpetrators redacted. In a House committee hearing, Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat from Washington, asked Attorney General Pam Bondi why she had violated the Epstein Files Transparency Act rules by blocking out perpetrator names while exposing the identities of nearly three dozen victims. She asked Bondi to personally apologize to the victims, some of whom were in the room, but Bondi said she was not going to get in the gutter with this woman. After members of Congress were given access to a less redacted tranche of 3.5 million documents, Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, said the Justice Department had initially withheld the names of six men implicated in criminal behavior. Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat from Maryland, said President Trump's name appeared more than a million times in the tranche, and that photos and texts suggested the victims of Epstein and his associates included 14-year-old girls, 10-year-old girls, adding, "I saw a reference today to a 9-year-old girl." Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick faced Senate questioning over emails that suggested he'd visited Epstein's Caribbean island compound in 2012 after claiming he cut ties with a convicted child sex offender years earlier. "He should just resign," said Massie. Chris Andrew lost his title for less than what we've seen Howard Lutnick lie about. What the columnist said, "Lutnick's Epstein problem is not going away," said Nia Prater in nymag.com. The Commerce Secretary insisted there were maybe 10 emails connecting him with the financier. In fact, his name is in more than 250 documents. Still, Lutnick doggedly downplayed his 14-year relationship with Epstein, telling the Senate that he'd only been on the notorious island for an hour. So far, the White House is sticking by Lutnick and has no plans for his removal. Other powerful people also continue to associate with Epstein after his slap on the wrist 2008 conviction for soliciting a minor, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker. The sleaze is bipartisan, encompassing major Democratic and Republican donors. Among the names concealed by the DOJ but mentioned by lawmakers was Sultan Ahmed bin Sulayem of the United Arab Emirates. Epstein sent him an alarming email saying he loved the torture video. We've only begun to mine the many terrible secrets buried in the Epstein files, said Molly Jong Fast in the New York Times. Epstein knew pretty much everybody, name-dropping, favor-trading, sex trafficking, and possibly blackmailing his way all the way up, up, up. The rich loved the goodies he could provide, Prada handbags, help getting a kid a job, and yes, sexual access to girls and women. At least five European officials have resigned over the latest Epstein revelations, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. In the U.S., no politician has yet to do so. The message to America's plutocrats, they can get away with anything. Controversy of the week, media. Why did Bezos gut the Washington Post? The digital age has killed off thousands of American newspapers, said Ashley Parker in The Atlantic. But at the Washington Post, we're witnessing a murder. Last week, at the direction of its owner, Jeff Bezos, Post executive editor Matt Murray laid off, by Zoom, nearly half of the paper's editorial staff. More than 350 reporters, including correspondents reporting from the front line in Ukraine, and most of those covering the D.C. region. Explaining the cuts, Murray cited the paper's financial losses, $100 million in 2024 alone, which he blamed in part on the post-liberal slant. We too often write from one perspective, he said, for one slice of the audience. But these excuses make no sense, said Margaret Sullivan in The Guardian. The New York Times is profitable and expanding, with a political stance arguably to the left of the Post. And for Bezos, who is worth close to $250 billion and just casually splashed $75 million on a Melania Trump documentary that's leaving seats empty in a theater near you, the Post losses are essentially pocket change. Was this really a business decision, or did the Amazon founder gut the paper that brought down President Nixon to curry favor with President Trump? Bezos is wildly rich, it's true, said Ben Dominic in the New York Post. He could keep lighting cash on fire indefinitely if he wanted to keep the Post afloat and unchanged. But why would he want that? Any newspaper that loses $100 million a year is clearly not giving people the stories they want or need to read. For the Post to survive long-term, radical change is in order, including a return to the political center and away from race-focused, pro-transgender, anti-Trump coverage. The Post's 2017 reinvention as a democracy dies in darkness organ of resistance was good for a short-term spike in subscribers, said National Review in an editorial, but it didn't last. The notion that Bezos is somehow obligated to keep funding that failed experiment reeks of entitlement. But Bezos is largely to blame for the paper's woes, said Alec Kirshner in Slate. His 2024 decision to kill a planned endorsement of Kamala Harris drove away 250,000 paying subscribers, about 10% of the digital subscriber base. And the bleeding continued when he decreed that the opinion section would stop fretting about authoritarianism and focus instead on personal liberties for free markets. Nobody wanted a center-right post, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Now the paper's liberal subscribers, nor the conservatives Bezos hoped to woo, who prefer the insane slopaganda of cable news and social media. At this point, he should admit defeat and just sell the paper. There must be some civic-minded billionaire out there willing to save one of the world's great newspapers. It's not going to happen, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. In Trump's authoritarian America, what billionaire wants to invite a flood of frivolous 10-figure lawsuits, even criminal prosecutions, by funding journalism that holds the president accountable? And why would Bezos sell, asked Eoin Higgins in The Intercept. If he now does to The Post what billionaires Larry and David Ellison have done to CBS News, gutting the newsroom and imparting a rightward Trump-friendly spin to its coverage, he'll be lavishly rewarded in merger approvals and new government contracts for his many ventures. Maybe there is some benevolent billionaire willing to swoop in and save The Post. But if Bezos has taught us anything, it's that billionaires are only benevolent until they're not. It's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for making lemonade after Kristen Cabot, the HR executive who went viral last year with a kiss cam at a Coldplay concert, caught her canoodling with her boss, was announced as keynote speaker at the upcoming Conference on Crisis Communications. Tickets to the event where Cabot will speak on taking back the narrative are priced between $750 and $875. It was a good week for vigilance. After President Trump told attendees at the National Prayer Breakfast that he doesn't sleep on planes, preferring instead to spend his time looking out the window, watching for missiles and enemies. It was a good week for baby steps. After Elon Musk announced on X that while he remains committed to building a human colony on Mars, his rocket company SpaceX is now prioritizing the construction of a self-growing city on the moon. The world's richest man said his overriding priority is securing the future of civilization, and the moon is faster. It's a bad week for champions. After athletes complain that the medals they've won at the Milan Cortina Winter Olympic Games are fragile and keep detaching from their ribbons. Don't jump in them, said women's downhill ski gold medalist Breezy Johnson. I was jumping in excitement, and it broke. It's a bad week for airmail. After an 80-pound Amazon delivery drone smashed into the side of an apartment building in a Dallas suburb and tumbled to the ground. The propellers on the thing were still moving, said a resident who filmed the crash, and you could smell it was starting to burn. Finally, it was a bad week for huffing and puffing. After researchers found that out-of-shape people are 775% more likely to lose their temper in stressful situations than their fitter contemporaries. Regular physical exercise can be a useful non-pharmacological strategy for anger management, the study authors coolly noted. And in other news, Trump strips protections from 50,000 federal workers. The Trump administration finalized a new policy last week that will remove job protections for up to 50,000 federal employees and make it easier for the White House to replace nonpartisan civil servants with ideologically aligned workers. For decades, only about 4,000 political appointees within the government could be fired at will. Other federal employees have stronger protections that largely insulate them from partisan interference. The new policy issued by the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, set to take effect on March 9th, would allow the administration to reclassify employees whom it considers to have policy-related roles as at-will workers. OPM officials said the rule is aimed in part at disciplining federal workers who stand in the way of Trump's agenda. When conscientious objection becomes sabotage, said OPM Director Scott Cooper, that is not allowed. And we're over to the briefing. Headline this week, Putin's Shadow War. The Kremlin is waging a campaign of sabotage and subversion against Ukraine's allies in the West. What is Russia doing? Since invading Ukraine in 2022, Russian President Vladimir Putin has sharply increased his hybrid war on the Western nations that support Kyiv. These hostile actions, which are too many to justify a full-scale military response and are always denied by Russia, have included blowing up rail lines in Poland, setting fire to a warehouse in London, severing communication and power cables under the Baltic Sea, cyber attacks on critical infrastructure, and jamming of civilian flights, and the deployment of drone swarms in Western airspace. Over the past 4 years, European officials have blamed at least 145 acts of sabotage and disruption on Russia. That number doesn't include Moscow's many disinformation campaigns or its funding of far-right parties in Europe. America has also been targeted. In 2024, intelligence agencies foiled a suspected Russian plot to plant incendiary devices on cargo and passenger planes flying from Europe to the U.S. and Canada. The new front line, said Blaise Metrowelli, head of the U.K.'s M16 intelligence agency, is everywhere. Is this a new strategy? The Soviet Union used what it called active measures during the Cold War, covert and deniable overseas operations that included assassinations, disinformation campaigns, and funding for friendly political movements. Putin, a former KGB agent, has embraced these tactics since taking power in 2000. Ukrainian politician Viktor Yushchenko was poisoned while challenging a pro-Kremlin presidential candidate in 2004. In a 2014, so-called Little Green Men, masked Russian soldiers who Putin initially claimed were concerned locals, took control of the Ukrainian territory of Crimea. The start of the Ukraine war saw a dramatic escalation in hybrid operations. Sabotage and subversion attacks in Europe quadrupled from 2022 to 2023, and then tripled the following year. Russia's military intelligence service, the GRU, was likely behind many of the attacks, some of which hit targets directly linked to military support for Kyiv. Others, such as the planting of incendiary devices in the bedding section of a Lithuania IKEA in 2024, were aimed squarely at terrorizing citizens. What is the goal? Partly it's to drain target countries' intelligence and security resources. After an attack that may have cost only a few thousand dollars to arrange, we in Europe follow up with an investigation that takes months, said Bart Sherman, a political violence researcher in the Netherlands. Meanwhile, they're long on to the next one. Definitively, proving Russia's culpability can be difficult because it has built a gig economy of saboteurs, recruiting young men online and paying them in hard-to-trace cryptocurrency. Moscow has also used foreign-registered ships to damage undersea cables and pipelines, by dragging their anchors across the seabed. The overarching objective of these operations is to sway public opinion against supporting Ukraine. Such incidents are meant to spread uncertainty, fear, distrust, said Paulina Pacheca, a Polish expert on hybrid threats. People begin to wonder, look what's happening all around us because we're engaged in this war, which actually maybe isn't or shouldn't be our war. Are the attacks getting worse? In 2024, Russia began to attack bigger and higher profile targets. That March, a warehouse in East London that stored Ukraine-bound Starlink satellite terminals and other equipment went up in flames, causing $1.4 million in damage. Six British men were later convicted of national security and arson offenses. Ringleader Dylan Earle, 21, had been recruited by the Russian mercenary outfit Wagner and was paid about $12,000 for the attack. In May, the arsonist incinerated an 860,000-square-foot mega mall in Warsaw. An investigation found the blaze was ordered by the GRU. That same month, there was a fire at a Berlin factory owned by a German arms firm. Online investigations revealed Russian agents had researched fire protocols at the factory shortly before the blaze. Russians are not as stupid as to leave that breadcrumb trail, a European security source told the Telegraph. Sometimes they simply want us to find out they have flexed their muscles. It's part of the hybrid warfare. Has Russia kept up the pace of operations? Its campaign quieted in early 2025 as Putin sought to woo a newly inaugurated President Trump. But its offensive soon intensified. In September, a plane carrying European Union Commission leader Ursula von der Leyen had its GPS signals jammed as it approached an airport in Bulgaria. Throughout fall, swarms of suspected Russian drones appeared over European airports, as well as military bases in France, Denmark, and Germany. Up to four were shot down over Poland. And in November, two Russia-backed saboteurs used military-grade C4 explosives to blow up a stretch of rail line outside Warsaw, forcing a passenger train to screech to a halt. With each escalation, Moscow risks causing a high casualty event that could trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense clause, which states that an attack on one member is an attack on all. How is the West responding? By beefing up its defenses. After September's drone incursion, NATO said it would boost drone and air defenses on the alliance's eastern flank. But a growing number of voices want Europe to fight fire with fire. A more proactive response is needed, said Latvian Foreign Minister Babe Braz. And it's not talking that sends a signal, it's doing. Some defense experts have suggested cyber attacks on Russian drone factories and power plants. Other EU officials have considered information campaigns aimed at ordinary Russians. Europe will likely have to respond alone. Trump pulled the U.S. out of the NATO-affiliated European Center of Excellence for Countering Hybrid Threats in January. But doing nothing is not an option, Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto said in November. We are under attack, and the hybrid bombs continue to fall. The time to act is now. And a few of the best columns of the week. The first two come from the U.S. New caution on trans treatments. The transgender orthodoxy is cracking, said Megan McArdle, A jury recently awarded $2 million to a New York woman who sued her psychologist and plastic surgeon over a gender-affirming mastectomy she got at 16, saying they pressured her into the surgery and defied standards of care. The verdict puts practitioners on notice that pushing irreversible interventions carries risk. Last week, the American Medical Association and Society of Plastic Surgeons issued new, highly cautious policies about surgical interventions and hormone treatments for minors. These treatments should generally be deferred to adulthood, said the AMA. The ground is finally shifting toward reasonable caution after years in which dogmatic advocates condemned as transphobic anyone who dared question medicalizing the treatment of gender dysphoric children and teens. The thought police insisted that these troubled kids knew who they were and cited medical groups who backed pediatric transition as medically necessary and life-saving, despite a lack of solid research. Many detransitioners have come forward to express their regrets that because they listened to doctors, their bodies will never be the same. In some cases, pediatric interventions may be justified, but we need better evidence before making it standard medical practice. Senior care depends on immigrants. President Trump's attempts to revoke temporary protected status for Haitian and other immigrants could be a disaster for elderly people needing nursing care, said Jonathan Cohn. Trump and his MAGA brethren have portrayed the refugees from Haiti and other, quote, shithole countries as a burden on society, who eat their neighbors' dogs and cats. But it's difficult to imagine what care for seniors and people with disabilities would even look like without a large immigrant component. Analyses from health policy organizations show that foreign-born Americans and non-citizens make up 28% of the workforce in nursing homes and home care. Providing care to elders who are infirm or have dementia is both physically and emotionally taxing. Workers have to lift their aged clients out of bed and chairs, clean human waste, and watch them fade and die. These are jobs few Americans want. In this industry, Haitian care workers are widely known to be empathetic and diligent. If Trump manages to deport hundreds of thousands of immigrants with TPS, it will lead to dramatic labor shortages in nursing care, price hikes, and long waiting lists. Immigrants won't be the only ones to suffer. And this column comes from Haiti itself, struggling to make room for deportees. Haitians terrorized by bloodthirsty gangs have no safe place to go, said Darcy Bertrand. Yet we still have to find a way to make room for returning expats. A massive exodus has been emptying Port-au-Prince, the capital, as residents are driven out by extreme insecurity, kidnappings, gang violence, and the collapse of essential services. Hospitals and schools barely function, and nearly half of our roughly 12 million people are suffering acute hunger. Yet the Trump administration is now bent on sending hundreds of thousands of Haitians living in the U.S. back to this country in chaos. Some villagers here are already complaining that big city Haitians and those returning from abroad don't share their values. Such xenophobia has no place in a country whose motto is liberty, equality, fraternity. Yes, this influx puts real pressure on infrastructure and the cost of living, but those who had to flee their homes, whether after the 2010 earthquake or last year after gang violence, aren't coming out to the villages by choice. Are we forgetting that Haiti was established through a revolution that ended slavery, that we invented universal freedom? Haitians should know better than anyone that the promised land cannot be reached if a part of the people is left behind. And the last word, our feature article, the price of speaking out. A retiree emailed a federal official to urge mercy for an Afghan asylum seeker facing deportation, said John Woodrow Cox in the Washington Post. Hours later, the government began investigating him. He had decided that the America he believed in would not make it if people like him didn't speak up. So on a cool, rainy morning in the suburbs of Philadelphia, John, 67, and recently retired, marched up to his study and began to type. He had just read about the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's case against an Afghan it was trying to deport. The immigrant, identified in the Washington Post investigation as H, had begged federal officials to reconsider, telling them the Taliban would kill him if he was returned to Afghanistan. Unconscionable, John thought, as he found an email address online for the lead prosecutor, Joseph Dernbach, who was named in the story. Peering through metal-rimmed glasses, John opened Gmail on his computer monitor. "Mr. Dernbach, don't play Russian roulette with H's life," he wrote. "Err on the side of caution. There's a reason the U.S. government, along with many other governments, don't recognize the Taliban. Apply the principles of common sense and decency." That was it. In 5 minutes, John said, he finished the note, signed his first and last name, pressed send, and hoped his plea would make a difference. 5 hours and 1 minute later, John was watching TV with his wife when an email popped up in his inbox. He noticed it on his phone. "Google," the message read, "has received legal process from a law enforcement authority compelling the release of information related to your Google account." Listed below was the type of legal process, subpoena, and below that, the authority, Department of Homeland Security. That's how it began. Soon would come a knock at the door by men with badges, and for John, the relentless feeling of being surveilled in a country where he never imagined he would be. Google hadn't provided him with a copy of the subpoena, but it wasn't the conventional sort. For many Americans, the anonymous ICE officer, masked and armed, represents Homeland Security's most intimidating instrument. But the agency often targets people in a far more secretive way. It had come after him with what's known as an administrative subpoena, a powerful legal tool that, unlike the ones people are most familiar with, federal agencies can issue without an order from a judge or grand jury. Though the U.S. government has been accused under previous administrations of overstepping laws and guidelines that restrict the subpoena's use, privacy and civil rights groups say that under President Trump, Homeland Security has weaponized the tool to strangle free speech. Homeland Security is not required to share how many administrative subpoenas it issues each year, but tech experts and former agency staff estimate it's well into the thousands, if not tens of thousands. Because the legal demands are not subject to independent review, they can take just minutes to write up and, former staff say, officials throughout the agency, even mid-level roles, have been given the authority to approve them. In September, Homeland Security used one to try to identify Instagram users who posted about ICE raids in Los Angeles. Last month, the agency used another to demand detailed personal information about some 7,000 workers in a Minnesota health system whose staff had protested ICE's intrusion into one of their hospitals. There's no oversight ahead of time, and there's no ramifications for having abused it after the fact, said Jennifer Granick, an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. Since the start of Trump's second term, the ACLU has repeatedly heard from people whom Homeland Security targeted with administrative subpoenas, the organization says. It's taken on three of those cases, but none of them, its attorneys say, illustrate how the agency has exploited that legal power better than John's. Google didn't tell John, who asked that the Post withhold his last name out of fear for his family's safety, what information the government officials wanted. But to keep them from getting it, he would have to file a motion in federal court and submit it to Google within 7 days. John's heart thudded in his ears. Unsure of what to do, he told his wife, "This is crazy," she said. "How can our government be doing this?" Born in England to a Jewish family, John grew up hearing of how his mother at 20 joined an intelligence service to help Britain fight the Nazis. In the mid-1980s, he supported mine workers in their bitter dispute with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. In 1989, having fallen for a girl from Philly, he moved with her to the U.S. and applied for citizenship a few years later, because this was his home now, and he wanted to vote for the people in charge of it. He admired the Constitution he'd studied before swearing his oath of allegiance. The rights it guaranteed made the country unlike any in the world, John thought, and he was proud to be part of it. Now in his 27th year as a citizen, he was staring at his phone, terrified that the same country was trying to strip him of those rights. Proponents describe administrative subpoenas as critical tools that allow investigators to avoid protracted judicial reviews to obtain information that could, for example, help them identify someone sexually exploiting a child or track down a suspected drug trafficker. The U.S. government has issued such subpoenas for decades, but their use expanded and became more controversial after the 9/11 attacks. A vast range of agencies, from the FBI to the Labor Department, can deploy them for specific types of investigations. Speed is what makes them so useful, former and current federal investigators told the Post. With no external bureaucracy, the government can obtain phone, financial, and internet records in days. Detractors argue that the lack of independent oversight and the secrecy with which they can be wielded threaten core democratic principles. This vast administrative power has remained opaque even to those who receive these subpoenas and invisible to those who it affects most. Lindsay Nash, a professor and researcher, wrote for the Columbia Law Review last year. Like other large tech firms, Google regularly publishes transparency reports that show how many government demands for user data it receives. But the companies don't differentiate between judicial and administrative subpoenas. Both Google and Meta received a record number of subpoenas in the U.S. during the first half of last year, as Trump began his second term, according to the company's most recent reports. Google was sent 28,622, a 15% increase over the previous 6 months. Poring over Reddit posts and old news coverage, John eventually worked out on his own that the Google subpoena was not judicial, but administrative. But discovering the nature of his subpoena made it no easier to obtain. Google had notified him from a no-reply address and directed him to request a copy from Homeland Security, but didn't provide a home phone number. John's efforts to reach the agency led to a maddening hours-long circuit of answering machines, dead numbers, and uninterested attendants. He kept searching for answers as Google's deadline passed. In the case of the Instagram users posting about ICE raids, he read, the government dropped its case after the ACLU filed a 40-page legal challenge. In a similar case in Pennsylvania, Homeland Security asked Meta to identify the people behind a Facebook and Instagram account that tracked ICE raids. Federal attorneys argued in court, in a court filing, that the accounts invited scrutiny when they posted pictures of ICE agents' faces, license plates, and weapons. A month later, it withdrew the subpoena and the case was closed. The more John learned about administrative subpoenas, the more troubled he was that many Americans had never heard of them. Beyond my personal situation is the bigger question of how they misuse their powers to target innocent victims across the board, he wrote one attorney. If this goes unchallenged, we are all complicit or vulnerable in allowing the government to abuse its powers. Through the window, his wife saw them coming. It's the police, she screamed. John hurried downstairs. It was about 9:30 on the morning of November 17th. On his porch, he found a local officer in uniform with two men in slacks and sports coats. We're with Homeland Security, he recalled one of them saying. They showed him their badges. His breath quickened, but he tried not to panic. A diabetic now on Social Security, John stands 5'6". He speaks in a plodding British accent, and unless he's watching a Tottenham Hotspur soccer match, he almost never raises his voice. But he'd seen videos of Homeland Security encounters that turned violent, even for women, teenagers, and old men. Inside, he could hear the dog yelping and his wife shouting, "Don't you have anything better to do?" One of the federal agents showed him a copy of the email to Dernbach. "We want to hear your side of the story," he recalled one of them saying. He told the men about his dismay over Homeland Security's attempt to deport the Afghan who'd supported the U.S. war effort. When they asked him how he knew Dernbach's email address, John, whose only social media is Facebook, told him he found it through a basic Google search. He also shared the notice from Google, which he said it seemed they had not seen. Someone from Homeland Security's headquarters in Washington had told their office to interview John, the men shared, though they didn't give a name. His message to Dernbach, John told them, was an opinion protected by the First Amendment. The investigators agreed the email broke no law, he said, but they pointed to his mentions of Russian roulette and the Taliban. Perhaps, they conjectured, the prosecutor felt threatened. That was absurd given the context, John thought, but he didn't say that. After about 20 minutes, the men thanked him for his time, but John had one more question. He sometimes returned to England to visit family, and he and his wife had planned to travel to Puerto Rico for their 40th wedding anniversary. "I hope this doesn't mean I'm going to get stopped at the airport," he said. "Am I on a list now?" "Of course not," he said, the men told him. He had nothing to worry about. On November 21st, a Post reporter contacted Google about John's case. 2 hours after that, 2 days after Google notified John of the subpoena, the company provided him a copy. The investigators who questioned John told him Homeland Security couldn't obtain his emails, documents, photos, or other content with an administrative subpoena, he said. But the breadth of what federal investigators did ask for shook him. Among their demands, which they wanted dating back to September 1, the day, time, and duration of all his online sessions, every associated IP and physical address, a list of each service he used, any alternate usernames and email addresses, the date he'd opened an account, his credit card, driver's license, and Social Security numbers. Then came another revelation 3 days later when Google informed him that it had not yet responded to Homeland Security's legal demand. The ACLU agreed to represent John pro bono, filing a motion to quash in federal court to prevent Google from ever releasing his information. It doesn't take that much to make people look over their shoulder to think twice before they speak again, said Nathan Freed Whistler, one of the ACLU attorneys. That's why these kinds of subpoenas and other actions, the visits, are so pernicious. The knowledge that Google never sent the government the information it requested both comforted and unnerved John, because it meant that those two federal agents had tracked him down some other way. What if the U.S. government had investigated him in other ways? And what if it still was? In the weeks that followed, John tried to turn his attention to the holidays and his anniversary trip with his wife. Just before Christmas, the couple left for Puerto Rico. At the airport outside San Juan, they waited at baggage claim until every other passenger had left. Their luggage, they were told, remained in Philadelphia. "Is this a coincidence?" he asked his wife. The bags arrived at their cruise ship later that night, and the couple opened them in the cabin. Nothing looked out of place, but in John's he found a notice from the Transportation Security Administration. "Your bag," the standard form read, "was among those selected for physical inspection." It did not explain why. John didn't want to talk about what it might mean, not then. So he took a photo, closed the bag, and tried to go to sleep. This was adapted from an article first published in the Washington Post. We're on the Talking Points page with that article referenced in the cover drawing. Trump whitewashing American history. The Trump administration is deleting American history, said Maxine Joselow and Jennifer Schussler in the New York Times. At more than two dozen parks and monuments across the country, the National Park Service is carrying out Trump's directive to remove or rewrite plaques that disparage Americans or promote corrosive ideology about slavery, racism, sexism, gay rights, or the persecution of Native Americans. In Philadelphia, Park Service workers used crowbars to pull down plaques at the President's House site that explained the history of slavery and stated that George Washington kept 9 enslaved people there. At the Little Bighorn Monument in Montana, the Park Service plans to remove plaques that address broken promises to Native American tribes and the deliberate erasure of indigenous culture and language. Brochures at the Medgar Evers monuments in Mississippi that refer to the civil rights activist killer, a Klansman, as a racist, were also removed. Even references to climate change and geological time are now verboten. Trump is trying to erase any history that exposes this nation's curated version of itself, said Renee Graham in the Boston Globe. His executive order, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, reads like a paean to white supremacist revisionism. He's determined to bury the 246 years of black enslavement, Jim Crow laws, lynchings, and race massacres, and the genocide of Native Americans. That's because white supremacy, the undergirding of Trump's political career, is so fragile that it withers in the face of unvarnished history. Trump works overtime to keep Americans divided, said Keith A. Owens in the Detroit Free Press. The fact that he was elected twice proves that much of this country can't face the truth of who we are as Americans and prefer Trump's whitewashed and romanticized version. Just imagine what he'll do to the nation's big celebration of its 250th birthday this year, said Dan Friedman and Amanda Moore and Mother Jones. Trump has filled Task Force 250 with hardcore loyalists who are planning a jingoistic MAGA-style celebration of far-right values, with no mention of immigrants, civil rights heroes, or any notable women at all. Trump has promised what he called a major prayer event on the National Mall. The question is whether America 250 will celebrate the ideals of the country's founders or those of the monarch they rebelled against. And a few of the shorter notes. Minneapolis businesses are losing $10 million to $20 million a week as shoppers, diners, and workers stay home amid the federal immigration crackdown, according to city estimates. The downturn is hitting immigrant-owned businesses especially hard, with 1,000 such businesses on the Lake Street corridor losing a collective $46 million in December and January. Top donors to Freedom 250, a new group allied with President Trump that is planning events around the U.S.'s 250th birthday this summer, are being promised access to Trump. Those who give $1 million or more will get invites to a private reception hosted by Trump with a historic photo opportunity. Active duty military members are being pressured by superiors to attend screenings of Melania, the new documentary about First Lady Melania Trump, according to the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. The nonprofit has received reports from 8 military bases around the world of personnel being pushed to see the film. One commander reportedly designated an off-base showing of Melania as a morale-boosting unit activity event. Less than 14% of the nearly 400,000 immigrants arrested by ICE over the last year had charges or convictions for violent criminal offenses, according to a Homeland Security report. And let's see, we've got time for a couple of quotes. David Frost says, "Television is an invention that permits you to be entertained in your living room by people you wouldn't have in your home." And Henry David Thoreau has a nice thought. "There is no remedy for love but to love more." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the Week Magazine. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.